It's fun, don't get me wrong. You know, having a team with Trout and Betts is fun. Like, you're going to have fun watching that team, but you're probably also going to finish at best like fifth or sixth, just because in an AL only where the replacement level's garbage, and even in a deep mix, to get back to where you need to get to, you're probably not going to be able to do it, to your point. Episode 187 of Flags Fly Forever, a baseball perspectives podcast. I am your host, Mike Gianella. Behind the glass, as always, we have Jed Mock Ramos of the BP Stats team. And tonight we have a very special guest co-host. He is a new or one of the newest members of Baseball Prospectus, Baseball Prospectus fantasy writer, but also, more importantly, a former NFBC champion. I guess once you're an NFBC champion, you're always an NFBC champion. I'm sure by now you know who I'm talking about. Rob Silver. Rob, welcome to the podcast.
It would really, really upset me if they tried to strip my title from 2016 at this point. The money's gone. Like, if they come to my house, I'm not answering the door. It's good to be here. It was a ton of fun being on last year talking starting pitchers. So now that I write for BP, it's going to be even more fun this year.
Yeah, and we're going to definitely have you on more often now that you're part of the fold. You know, Zach and I have primarily been doing the show, but I think as the year goes on, we want to integrate both guests, but also, you know, a lot of our writers, like, you know, John Hegland, who is in the Champions League of TGFBI, would be great to have on. Darius Austin, who's with me in the CBS AL League, which we just completed. Just a lot of good content and, you know, a lot that we can talk about. Before we get going, I just want to do our usual housekeeping. The BP Annual is out right now. Don't forget to go out and, you know, look at that at Amazon.com, where there's a big discount. There's some other sites that have discounts as well. Our fantasy coverage is winding down, but as far as the positions, we are in starting pitcher week. But, you know, as noted, we're going to end with relief week next week, but that doesn't mean it ends. We're going to have plenty of coverage of labor and tout wars in March, in addition to some other content gearing up for the season. My fantasy valuations are slated to come out on Wednesday. That's the first edition of bid limits for AL only, NL only, and deeper mixed leagues. And once again, don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes, Stitcher, and all those great places. Those ratings do go a long way. So I'm going to just let our listeners know, we've been going through the tiers in my tier rankings, which I compile, but the staff contributes to. We're gonna shift a little bit this week. I want to talk strategy with Rob, just because Rob has been so successful in NFBC. You know, he's a champion. He's also done very well in other seasons there. He has a great approach. And so I want to kind of pick your brain, Rob, rather than just run through the tiers and kind of do, I like this pitcher, I don't like that pitcher. I think that's kind of, I mean, it's interesting to know. I mean, you're knowledgeable, I'm knowledgeable. So, you know, it might be useful for us to, you know, talk for 20 minutes about Walker Buehler, but everybody likes Walker Buehler. So I want to.
Except you. You're the one guy who's not sold on Walker Buehler. So maybe we will talk about Walker Buehler for 20 minutes.
Maybe, but I think it's more a matter of, and this is where the nuance comes in. I like Walker Buehler probably slightly less than everyone else, which in these leagues does make a difference, because you're right. Like, if, you know, you everybody thinks he's a late second round, early third round, and I think he's a late third round, all that means is I'm never going to get him unless I'm one of those people who's in 20 leagues and get him in one. You're absolutely right. What I did want to do, the TGFBI drafts are going on right now. And as I mentioned before the show, we're not going to talk too much about that. And we're not going to get into it, because there's a lot of navel gazing. There's a lot of, this is who I've drafted so far. I don't know if it was you, Rob, or Jeff Zimmerman of Fangraphs was joking about that this morning on Twitter, which is like, you know, everybody through the first three rounds thinks their team is great. And there's something to that, because honestly, you know, no one's taking people in the first three rounds. We're like, oh, I can't believe I took this person. What a mistake. The perception of the first 45 players in any draft is going to be a great perception, even though we know that probably a third to half of those players are, well, not going to live up to their, you know, expectations. I mean, I'd say a third of them are going to fail. They're just not going to do, you know, Gary Sanchez, Josh Donaldson, Brian Dozier. I'm not going to run through the list of last year's failures, but we know what happens. But what I do want to talk about a little bit, I want to talk about process, because Clayton Kershaw. So Clayton Kershaw, when these drafts started on Sunday, as we're talking, that was yesterday, the 24th, these drafts started at 1 p.m. Eastern. And Clayton Kershaw's ADP, I believe, and this is the Draft Champions ADP that you've touted us to use, Rob, correctly. I think it was around 39. Is that, correct me if I'm wrong.
I have up the Draft Champions from the NFBC since February 1st and 39.84 in 25 drafts. So yeah, 40th pick, 13th pitcher off the board.
Okay, right. So, I'm sorry, would you say the 15th pitcher or the
13th pitcher, 13th right after pitcher. Right, okay. After Walker Buehler.
That's good. That's actually good information, because that ties into some of the data that I called together. So, where I want to bring up TGFBI is, you know, we've seen the news on Kershaw. His shoulder, well, first there was an undisclosed injury, which always, you know, makes us nervous, because if it's not a serious injury, usually you hear about it right away, unless they don't know what it is. But even then, you know, the team will say, oh, you know, it's minor, or, you know, we don't know what it is, but we think he'll be back in a day. This was the ominous undisclosed injury. And then, you know, came out it was his shoulder, which, you know, makes everybody cringe. And now today, just a couple hours before we started recording this, yeah, the news kind of went from seeming bad to like seeming really bad, where if I had to guess, I'd say Clayton Kershaw is not going to be ready on opening day. I mean, I could be wrong, and I'm just making a guess. I'm not expressing, you know, adamant or, you know, metaphysical confidence, but that would be my guess. So in the TGFBI drafts, there's a very interesting, there's 21 leagues. There's a very interesting range of picks. So he's gone in the second round in two of these 21 drafts. He went in the third round in four of them. He went in the fourth round, and this seems to be where the common landing place was for him, in 11. He went in the fifth round in two. And then the League of Champions, which is where they assembled everybody who won their respective TGFBI leagues last year, he went the furthest. He slipped all the way to the sixth round and the 81st pick overall. There's one league, by the way, that's very slow, and they just started their fourth round and he hasn't been picked. So I wanted to kind of ask you a couple things to kick off this discussion. I think the biggest question, Rob, is how do you deal, like, in a draft like this, or really in any draft, because you probably don't do slow drafts for the most part, but how do you, let's say you come to the table and let's say you came to the table Sunday morning for a non-slow draft and you see news like that on Kershaw. Do you adjust? Have you made those adjustments already based on where Kershaw was last year? Do you have a process, or is it just kind of a feel thing for you? I mean, I know the answer to this, but I want the audience to hear it.
Yeah. So, I mean, if I were drafting Sunday or today, based on the information we have as of this moment, I've knocked him down to 140 innings. I think I had him high still. I had him, I think, at 175 or 180 innings before that. And even 140 innings, which knocks him all the way down to the 28th starting pitcher on my list. And the reason for that is obviously his strikeouts and wins go down correspondingly. And I have him below a strikeout an inning, just below, but below a strikeout per inning. So he's really not super elite at 140 innings. Still good, but really a low-end SP2, SP3 type pitcher. But I don't feel great about that, because the range of outcomes, like, we could find out, and obviously all of us, if we like baseball, want Clayton Kershaw to be healthy. We want Clayton Kershaw to be great again. There's nobody since Pedro Martinez that I've enjoyed watching more than Clayton Kershaw as just a baseball fan. That having been said, would it shock you if news came out saying he's not pitching this year, that he's going to have to require surgery? It wouldn't be shocking at this point. So the range of outcomes for Kershaw are immense, including that 3 weeks from now, he'll be Clayton Kershaw. And this is just a tired arm. You know, it's a bit of stiffness and he'll be back. And so he's a tough player to value at this point because of those ranges of outcomes. The other thing is, I'm assuming that he pitches 140 innings and he's still good. One of the scenarios, and we were having a Twitter exchange with Rudy Gamble from Razzball a few weeks back, is the Felix Hernandez path, which I don't think it was the likely path, or I didn't think a week or two ago that was a likely path, but he could pitch 140 innings, and they're not Clayton Kershaw innings anymore. They're 70%, 60%, 50% of Clayton Kershaw. That's concerning as a potential outcome as well.
Yeah, so there's a couple, there's a lot to kind of digest here, and I want to actually touch on Rudy's point first. So it's funny, Razzball just put out an updated starting pitcher ranks, and they're even lower on Kershaw than you are. They have him 37th now.
Yeah.
So they've really downgraded him. And I think that advice is saying, you know, don't touch Kershaw unless, you know, everyone in your league, you know, reads Razzball and also doesn't want to touch him and he's there. And you're like, well, you know, at that price, and they cater to 12 team leagues. So at that price, the front end SP4, what the heck? You know, you're already just kind of rolling this. So I'd argue in a 12 team league, you might only move him up more because of that potential upside that you just mentioned, Rob, that he's Clayton Kershaw. But the thing about that is that I do agree with all of that, those ranges and possibilities and where he can fall. You know, the one thing that's a little bit different than, well, there's two differences from Felix of a few years ago. The first difference, Clayton Kershaw was good last year operating with less velocity. He wasn't great. He wasn't the Clayton Kershaw of old. I'm not selling him as that, but he was effective. And, you know, effective means he had a couple of outings where he was in, you know, you looked at him and you're like, oh, you know, this isn't really a pitcher I want to watch or I'm not as excited about. But if you look at the overall numbers and even some of the peripherals, he was good. I'm not selling it as Clayton Kershaw was tremendous, but Felix really just dropped off a cliff. The second piece that I believe kind of works to Clayton Kershaw's advantage compared to Felix is Felix was still pitching in an era, I say era is only a few years ago, right, a time where the expectation was that he still was expected to go out and take the ball every fifth day, log 200 innings. I feel like regardless of what happens with Kershaw this year, the Dodgers weren't going to do that. It never seemed to me that he was someone, I know he wants to, and that's might be part of why he's hurt. He's pushing really hard. He didn't seem like a 210, 220 guy. He seemed to me like a 170, 180 inning guy to begin with. And that to me makes a bit of a difference where if it does turn out he's fine, I still don't expect a scenario where you're looking at 200 innings. And I don't know, but I don't want to, Rob, were you expecting 200 innings
before this
came out? Right.
No. I mean, I am conservative with my inning projections, like most projection systems. Yeah. So unless you're like Max Scherzer, you're not getting a 200 inning projection. You may get to 200, but no, Kershaw was below that. But he was top 10 in baseball in innings pitched in the second half. Like even with all the Dodgeritis, even once he came back from the injury, he wasn't vintage Kershaw, but he was pitching and he was pitching really well down the stretch last season.
No, I remember I had him on my Tout Wars team. And, you know, in the first half, I was pretty miserable about that. The second half, I was like, oh, you know, like I couldn't win at that point, but I could actually climb in the top three or four because he's really good.
So as tough as he is in a mixed league, where the good thing about a mixed league is you have a replacement option. You can take Stripling in the wherever Stripling is going to shoot up the board now, but you can pair Kershaw with somebody, especially in a draft, knowing you might lose playing time. The really tough question for you is if you were an NL labor, and let's assume you're sitting down at the labor table and you had the exact same information we had right now, how do you treat him in an NL only league where the replacement value, where the replacement player is a scrubbing reliever, really.
Well, what's complicated about that in labor compared to say Tout Wars is in labor, I can put Kershaw on the injured list, but I can't take my pitcher. I can't stream pitchers back and forth from reserve to active. So I don't have that luxury of being like, okay, like in town NL, I had Trevor Williams last year. I had Ulysses Chacin, who, you know, worked out. I kept him active all year. But you could move those pitchers back and forth and be like, okay, well, I'm going to, like, play around. Also, it's $0 bids. Labor is very restrictive. So you're right. That makes it – I'm actually – would push Kershaw down more in labor for that reason, because I need – not only do I need volume, I need those pitchers to actually, like, be out there, because I don't have the roster flexibility that I have in even a Tout Wars. So that's a good point.
So let's say you're in a more generic NL only league where you do have, you still have, let's say, a 7-man reserve roster, 8-man reserve roster. So it's not great, but you can't. How high do you think the bidding goes for Kershaw right now in an NL only league?
I probably high teens.
Yeah.
Maybe someone pushes him to 20, but it's tough because, you know, so one difference between the NL and the AL is the NL, there's still some depth there. It falls off, of course, because it's an only. But you look at some of those, like, mid-tier arms, and and even the aces. There's enough aces, you know, and if you want to include Flaherty and Tyon as aces, there's enough of those pitchers to go around that at this point I would probably in that format put them ahead of Kershaw. You know, the AL is a different story because, you know, after, like, you know, like a few pitchers, you're like, you know, I'd almost rather roll the dice on a Kershaw than go with a Jay Happ.
Would you rather, based on what we know right now, Rich Hill or Clayton Kershaw in an NL only league?
I'm still gonna take Kershaw just because Hill, you know, Hill's it's the same thing, but we've had it at this point for years, and with the exception of that one season, the ceiling isn't nearly as high. Kershaw still has a ceiling. I still believe 100%. That what we saw last year could be a reasonable outcome. Now, the one thing is I'm just not counting on I was never counting on the elite pre-2018 Kershaw. I guess that was always baked into the ranking for me. And, you know, to kind of bring it back to TGFBI, the two teams that took him in the second round and one in the early third round, those picks to me were bizarre even before the news, because I believe before the news came out, I had Kershaw ranked like in the mid-30s. And it's like, yeah, and even that was a little generous, where I didn't know if I'd take him there, depending on how my draft was going, which is interesting about rankings, and we'll get into that in a second. If you pick him in the late second round, you were betting on something of a performance bounce back, weren't you?
Or there was a massive starting pitcher run in that second round. So if I had him as my 12th starting pitcher and 11 starting pitchers went, and there were, you know, four more teams going into the turn, so 8 picks before it got back to me, I could see why you would jump Kershaw in that scenario. But that's the only way.
Well, and in the interest of full disclosure, so he went 7th overall in both those leagues. So there wasn't the run. I mean, in fairness, I have this in front of me. I didn't share this with you.
That's okay.
Part of why I took Kershaw in my league is that he was 51st overall, and there was exactly that run. He was a 17th pitcher overall, but I could see the pitchers at that point flying off the board. I believe my next pick was 70. And I was like, yeah, I can't wait. I didn't like the pitchers there. Like I think I was looking at the pitchers I was looking at besides him. And I was like, So I'm like, I don't want to take someone else at this point. I'd rather still gamble on the upside. And two, I didn't want to wait till 70 and see what the pitchers were. And based on what happened, I'm glad I didn't.
Yeah, no, and that is one of the big differences between straight drafts and auctions, obviously. In a straight draft, like, you need to make a decision. Are you willing to have Madison Bumgarner as your number one starting pitcher? And if you're not in your position, then you had to take somebody. And if Kershaw was your top pitcher, then you took Kershaw, because otherwise it is eminently possible that Flaherty's gone, Greinke's gone, Clevinger's gone, Strasburg's gone, Tyon's gone, and you're looking at, you know, Wheeler or Bumgarner, you know, and you're picking through those guys, which can work. That's what Clay did last year, and he won the overall, so it can work.
Brett,
you just need
Brett
a strategy.
Brett and I did it in labor a few years ago, and we've talked about this offline. Yeah. You know, and the funny thing about that league, and with Kershaw, and this is an interesting intersection, our first pitcher that year was Adam Wainwright in the 5th round. And, you know, Wainwright was coming off of, you know, Wainwright, that was the year he was coming off the injury, and he blew out his arch or his Achilles, whatever that injury was. He had like 4 or 5 starts, and he was gone. And we, but behind him, we had Cole, Arrieta, and DeGrom. And you know, Arrieta won the Cy. Cole was not Cole he was last year, but he's really good. And you know, DeGrom, you know, was a stud, or not what he was now, also, but again. So yeah, it can work. You know, the thing with that, if you're going to do that, I think in Clay's strategy was similar. At that point, you probably want to start playing the upside game as opposed to taking the boring, you know, veteran armor. You're like, yeah, you know, this guy will be okay, but he's not going to, you know, unless something really goes right, like he's not going to come out and suddenly be an ace. Like I'm thinking of someone like Kyle Hendricks. Kyle Hendricks is solid to me, and I've always been a Hendricks fan. It's unlikely he's going to replicate that one big year that he had. I mean, he could, but it's really unlikely.
Yeah, Kyle Hendricks is a great pick if you have a, you know, if you have Max Scherzer. If you have a 300 strikeout guy and you just need more volume and you feel like you're going to get some strikeouts later, if you've taken, let's say, Scherzer and one of the elite closers, so you have an advantage on your first closer in terms of strikeouts, Hendricks, he's not a guy I usually end up with, but he's, there are lots of roster construction situations where Hendricks is a fine pick. But no, if he's your second starting pitcher, he's probably not what you're looking for.
Yeah, and if he is, you're going to your point, that's a great point. Unless you have that elite 100 strikeout reliever, you're going to need a lot. And yeah. I mean a lot of strikeouts on the back end. And again, you know, you can get lucky on the back end. Last year, you know, someone I liked was Miles Michaelis, who I just couldn't believe was sitting, particularly in early drafts too. And this is also important with timing and why I think it was, you know, I've seen people say, you know, get in these drafts early, like especially if you're subscribing or paying for things, like use it to your advantage. By the time mid to late March rolls around, even the late bloom, you know, the late comers have looked at all this and processed it. And I looked at Michaelis and I dove in and I was like, you know, I don't think he's be what he was last year, but I thought he's gonna be like a three, you know, a back end three, a solid pitcher, and he was going like in the 20th, 22nd round. So you can certainly make up pitching if you don't draft it early. And this is kind of a good segue off of Kershaw to a general topic here. But you probably should try. That kind of leads to my next question. So do you have an overall strategy on starting pitching at NFBC? Like, do you go in saying, I have to have an ace or I have to take a pitcher in the second round? Does it depend? You know, and I know some of it can depend on your competition and who you're playing in and what the format is. But Rob, do you have an overall like approach?
It changes each year. There are pockets of talent that I like. So I'm not a tier drafter when I'm drafting. I have my valuations. I spend a lot of time at them. I like how you set it up at BP in terms of as a thought process. But once I hit the table, like despite the fact that I'm not a tier drafter, there are pockets. So, for example, this year, there's a pocket of starting pitchers going from mid-second round to beginning of third round that I have preferences between Gerrit Cole, Aaron Nola, Blake Snell, Trevor Bauer. Like, I like some of them more than I like others of them. But they're largely fungible. Like, I'm not going to leave a draft saying, I can't believe I got Blake Snell instead of Gerrit Cole. My season might as well. Like, no, they're both pretty darn close. And I don't have a crystal ball who's ultimately going to have a better season. Similarly, like in the 10th round, there's Bieber, there's Heaney, there's a bunch of comparable pitchers. And I have preferences, but you know, I can make it work with lots of those different guys. What I like to do is look in if you are going into an auction, you would have a pretty good sense. I want to spend X amount of dollars on pitching, and I want to break up that X percent. Let's call it $75. Just picking a number. And let's say you say in this auction, I want to spend $18 on two closers. I'm going to get a $13 closer and a crappy $5 closer and the rest on starting pitchers. And I think I'm going to do it $20 on one guy, $15 on one guy, and so on. And in any auction, when you go in with that written down on your paper or on your Excel sheet on your laptop, it's not gospel. Like if there's a deal you like there, you can go over and shift around money. But almost everybody would go into an auction with some sense of how they want to allocate their resources, and then they react to what's actually going on and how the draft unfolds. And I treat straight drafts similarly. So let's say I go into a draft this year and I say I want my first starting pitcher in the second round, and let's say I have, you know, the seventh pick overall. So I'm going to try to get a pitcher there, and then my next pitcher I'm going to take in the fifth round, and then I'm going to take a closer in the eighth round. I kind of flush that out, and I've talked about this before, and I've written about this. I turn it into dollar figures. So I have a sense that I'm spending in draft assets and picks that $75, the same as I would in an auction. And it's not science, and I don't pretend that it's science. And obviously, if in the fourth round instead of the fifth round, there's a pitcher I love that's there, you know, Jack Flaherty's still there, it's a great buy at that point, then I shift things around. And I'm not a slave to it. But especially in the NFBC or in TGIFB, the Great Fantasy Invitational, you need a balanced team. There's no trading. And it's really hard to win if you skew too far either way. So that process for me helps me stay relatively balanced, I find.
Yeah, and it's, you know, I did a draft and hold. I don't have as much experience with you do as no trades, but I did a draft and hold last year, which is, you know, it's a little different. It's 50 rounds, but I was finding as I was going through it, it influenced my draft without a doubt, because there were places where I'm like, oh, you know, I don't really like this player as much as this player. But I was like, well, I'm looking at the board and I pretty much have to get steals here. I'm a little bit different than you in that I look more probably at blocks of rounds. But I do agree with you philosophically, which is I don't have this. I used to be more doctrinaire about drafts. I used to be like, I'm just have a straight ranking. I'm going off my ranking. And now I've gotten better at looking at how the draft unfolds. That was a good point you made, because we had Zach Steinhorn, our editor, on last week talking about his labor draft. And Zach made the point. He said, you know, most of the drafts I've done have been home leagues or less competitive or less tough than labor. You know, labor, you look at the participants, you know, most, if not all of them, are there because they're good at this. You know, they're not here because Steve likes them and, you know, thinks that they're nice people. And Zach, you know, he admitted, he was like, I was not taken aback, but the room was tougher than I was used to. And I had a little bit of a hard time, you know, trying to get what I was trying to get. And one thing with Zach that, you know, to me, and I just wanted you to maybe clarify, Rob, what you said. Zach, to me, was a little doctrinaire with the way he set up things. Like, he was kind of like, you know, I have to get, you know, a pitcher in the second round. I have to get a corner in the third round. I have to get my speed in this round. I think there's something to that. But I also think that you do want to try, you know, if, for example, there's a run on, you know, speed and you look at the next speed player and it's a big drop, you might be like, well, I can see where that player should be going in ADP, and I'm just going to wait and kind of play into that next tier instead of just simply taking the next speed player and maybe missing out on not even a value, but better stats.
Yeah. And I like doing almost a logic tree of, what do I do it for? I do it for speed. I do it for saves. I do it for catchers. Those are the big ones whereby, like, look, if I draft Trey Turner in the first round, then it's not that I can ignore speed, but I stop looking at that as much. But assume I don't get any speed in the first. Let's say I get JD Martinez in the first round, then I go pitcher, then I go, you know, Chris Bryant. I want to load up in the third round, then another pitcher. So I know I need speed, but. So one approach is, well, my goodness, you know, Malik Smith is coming up. I've got to pounce on Malik Smith, and I know he's in eighth round ADP, and I know on my board he's like a seventh round value, but everybody needs speed. I better jump him to the sixth round. Mm. There's nothing wrong with that, because you do need your speed, but at the end of the day, if you're in something like the NFBC or, frankly, labor or like your own home league, to win, you need more value than you're spending. So in an auction, it's very obvious. You need your $320. It doesn't all have to come at the draft table. It won't all come at the draft table. But by the end of the season, you need that. And if you're spending, you know, you don't all, and I love this guy, so if this sounds catty, I don't mean it this way. Well, you don't need to be Larry Schechter. Larry Schechter, who's a great fantasy player, who's won lots of leagues and has written a great book on fantasy. But Larry is, I have this player valued at $17.52 and he's going for $15. So he's a buy. As soon as he gets to 18, he's not a good buy.
And I'm similar to Larry, but over the years, I started out as Larry. I started out as very doctrinaire and very much, you know, this is the price. And as I've gone along, I still have my price structure, but I've tried to explain to people over the years, this is a hierarchy. This isn't, and even in my case, sometimes if I get two closers early in an auction, it isn't a matter of, well, that's it. Like I have to buy, you know, six closers. You know, somebody did that once in a labor auction. I think it was five, and I'm not going to mention who it was, but they were all undervalued. They're undervalued because nobody was buying closers in that auction. And it's like, well, even a league like labor, you can trade. You're not going to win that way. And NFBC, you know, if the values are coming through and you take three closers in the first 10 rounds, it's ridiculous. There's no reason to do it. It just doesn't make sense.
But in any league, if you are routinely paying $22 for $17 players, I mean, they're projections. Right. Ultimately, the guy who you say is a $17 player could earn $28. But that you're kind of getting lucky. But if you're consistently overpaying, like dramatically overpaying, it's hard to get to your $320 right. worth of value. Like it's a tough, you're making the path a lot harder for you.
Yeah. And we had our CBS AL auction last Friday and somebody bought, you know, Mookie Betts and Mike Trout for 55 apiece. And, you know, he was happy about that. And I'm like, well, it's fun. Don't get me wrong. You know, having a team with Trout and Betts is fun. Like you're going to have fun watching that team, but you're probably also going to finish at best like fifth or sixth, just because in an AL only where the replacement level is garbage, and even in a deep mix, to get back to where you need to get to, you're probably not going to be able to do it, to your point, Rob, because you need that value. Now, in a draft, it's a little bit different, but absolutely, that's kind of the whole idea, which is if you're going with somebody, like if you're taking, you know, Malik Smith, and you're like, you know what, I believe in Malik Smith, this, that, the other, and I have him two or three rounds over ADP because I think that's where the value is. That's one thing. And I agree. Like I actually have Malik Smith valued fairly highly, and I might take him with my next pick for that reason. But the other side of that is if you're just like, well, I have to have speed, then you're absolutely right. You're shooting yourself in the
So this is where straight drafts. I started only doing auctions. I've like started doing my local AL only, NL only when I was a kid. Like, so this is a long time ago. But I thought straight drafts were boring. Like that's for football. They're boring. I love the strategy now in straight drafts. And this is where it comes up. So I'll use a real life example. I, like lots of people, think Nelson Cruz is still awesome. I value Nelson Cruz much higher than his ADP. So Nelson Cruz's ADP, sorry, while I look something up. I don't have it here. Anyways, I have at least two rounds ahead of his ADP. And there will
he's at 111, by the way, which I agree is ridiculous. He should be high.
So let's say I have him as the 60th ranked player on my board. It's at a certain point when my pick 60 comes up, when my pick 65, pick 70 comes up, he will be the highest ranked player on my board. And I have this formula that I stole from somebody because I'm not smart enough to come up with my own formulas for this kind of thing. They will tell me the exact percentage likelihood that he will be available, will still be there based on ADP at my next pick. And let's say when I'm picking two rounds before his current ADP, it says it's a 90% likelihood he'll be there. Is it a good bet to pass and take somebody I have lower than Nelson Cruz because it's only a 10% chance he's gone, even though I will be really pissed off if he's gone, because he is the best player to me. And that's the game of chicken. Game theory. Game theory is another word for it, but game theory or chicken that you have to play in straight drafts. So you love Malik Smith. Your next pick came up, and I don't know where you guys are in the draft. It doesn't really matter. It's, look, he's my best player. He's my best source of speed, certainly, and the next drop down is not – like, I don't want Billy Hamilton.
Yeah, it's more the latter than the former. I don't necessarily love him, but there's a gap, and I'm going to need speed at some point, and I'm going to have to probably – go after him or D. Gordon. Like that's kind of where I'm at. Yeah.
But the converse is, so on the one hand, it's don't be a slave to ADP. Like if there's a value there and it's a good pick and you're not being desperate and you're not being crazy and it's not just, man, it would be a lot of fun to have Vlad Guerrero on my team in his rookie season. I'm taking him because this is going to be awesome. It's your fantasy team. Do whatever makes you happy. Do you, but take Vlad because you think he's a good pick, not because it's going to be super fun, would be my approach. But the converse is, if you're trying to maximize value on your team, there's no doubt that me getting Nelson Cruz in the seventh round gives me a better probability of maximizing total value on my team than me taking Nelson Cruz in the fifth round. But me losing out on Nelson Cruz in the sixth round really screws my efforts to maximize my value in the draft.
Yeah, I have a cruder approach, but like a good example in my TGFBI, I took Justin Upton in the sixth round. I actually had him valued in the fifth round, and I kind of looked at it like, well, he's going on average like in the seventh, and I think like late in the seventh. There's no reason for me to take him in the fifth round. Like I could, and I would have felt fine with it, but that was my game theory there. I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to wait and do that. And you're absolutely right. Like the game theory in auctions is different from the standpoint of, you know, and we've seen this in Tout Wars for years. It's changed because starting pitching has changed, but it used to be no one paid for starting pitching. You can laugh about that now, but that used to be the case.
Yeah. It's so, the Ron Chandler, like, taught us all. It's a low inning, you know, like all of that. And we all flew from that. Totally.
Right. So Roy Halladay, like I remember Roy Halladay when there was 1 year I was in that league, and Roy Halladay is with the Phillies in his prime. You know, I get Roy Halladay. I'm happy as a clam. He's the first player that comes out. I think I'm for like the low 30s. The problem was all these other starting pitchers sunk. And there were pitchers who were maybe like 90 to 95% as good. Well, not all of them, but you're in pitchers 80% as good as Roy Halladay going for like 20 or 18. And I'm like, oh, like I'm not upset. I have Roy Halladay. He's wonderful. But that's the game in auctions. The game in drafts is similar, but you're absolutely right. It's a different kind of, you know, it's a different kind of philosophy in that you can reach sometimes, but you can't reach all the time. And I do agree with you. I started out in auctions. I was very resistant to drafts for years and years. And now I enjoy them. Now I do find them challenging. They're a different challenge. I don't like shallower drafts because I don't find them nearly as challenging. And I also feel like you're diluting the value of your draft, the 10 or 12 team league. Because in a deep league, like a 15 team league, the draft still matters quite a bit. But, you know, again, to each their own. If you like a 10-team mixed league, go ahead. You're just probably not getting a lot of value reading BP because we're not really aiming at that audience for the most part. I wanted to move back to starting pitchers because I know we could talk about this all night and have like a two-hour podcast, but this is a starting pitcher podcast. So I just wanted to kind of touch upon some other like strategies. So is it ever a good idea to, because I've seen Scott Pianowski of Yahoo has done this in labor the last couple of years, and I think he's done it in a lot of his drafts. He'll wait on starting pitching. Like, he'll wait a long time. Do you think there's any merit to that, or do you feel like that's a detriment where if you wait past, say, a certain round, like, say, six, seven rounds, that it's a bad play?
So I think, first off, I'd separate out a standalone league from a competition with an overall prize. If you're trying to compete against 450 other teams, it is really tough unless you have it is almost impossible to pull off if you have an overall prize. Assume it's a standalone league, which is where at least I've seen Scott do it in a standalone experts league. It can be done. I think that you need to either spend on closers so that you have the strong base of saves as well as ratios and strikeouts coming from them. Like you need some approach of how am I getting the points out of the 75 pitching points in a 15 team mixed league? Where do I think my points are going to come from? And if you have a strategy to get like 35 to 40 out of them, that can obviously work if your lineup in a competitive league, if your lineup is pretty dominant. It's where I don't think it works is if you just go in and saying, I'm not taking any pitchers for the first 14 rounds. I'm going to take, you know, I'm going to fill my lineup and then I'll see who's left. I'll get the best pitchers who are left. That I think is a little trickier to pull off. But it's the same as, you know, the Doug Dennis $20 pitching staff. It can work. It's really tough though. It's not easy.
Yeah. So I've fallen into that Doug Dennis staff by accident a couple times in only leagues. And I've done actually three times and I've done well, but I haven't won.
Yeah.
And my feeling, even in a standalone, you can be competitive. It's difficult to win. And you know, labor tout those leagues, you know, even though there's trading, it's difficult to trade in those leagues. And some of the, there's difficulty for a couple reasons. One reason is everybody wants to win the trade. That's true in every league, but in an expert league where people write about their trades or write about their teams, there's that sense of like, oh gosh, I don't want to make a trade where, you know, 6 months from now or 4 months from now, someone's writing their recap and like, I won because Mike Gianella traded me, you know, Starling Marte for Kyle Hendricks, which is a trade I actually made last year. So that's kind of like what it comes down to for a lot of people. They're so afraid to lose the edge. And then the other piece of it is there's kind of an etiquette, which I found weird when I first started participating in these leagues, where if someone's in like sixth or seventh place, they have absolutely no chance of winning. They don't want to make a trade with the second place team to push them over the top, even if it is a seventh place team's advantage. And, you know, they can finish fourth. They're like, well, no one's going to remember who finished fourth. But if this person wins because I made this trade, then it's going to be stupid. Zach and I ran the labor NL team last year, and we had a really hard time trading because Howard Bender of Fantasy Alarm looked like he was running away with it for months and months. And it was a three or four team race, and all the teams at the bottom just couldn't be bothered. So, yeah, there's a lot of moving parts to, you know, how that works. And I should point out, Scott this year wasn't as radical in labor. He took Michaelis in the sixth round. Then it was all the way to the 11th round with Nick Pivetta. So it was a very hitter heavy strategy. But to your point, Rob, it's a standalone where it is very different.
Yeah, no, I actually quite liked his pitching staff that he pulled off this time. I think Michaelis gives him the whip. So and Pivetta is the type of I'm not as high on Pivetta as Pacoda or lots of other people are, but he's he's a big upside play, and I fully recognize the upside that's there with Pivetta. So I actually think this year, as compared to last year, Scott struck a better balance. I mean, we'll see how it plays out, but I thought this year that's the kind of balance that could absolutely work out as long as you hit on the right guys.
And I think to go back to, like, you know, drafts like TGFBI or NFBC, if there's a large pool and it's a winner take all, and you're not just competing, you know, in a league that's a satellite or limited, it is different for that reason. Like you can't. I made this mistake in TGFBI last year. I didn't have enough pitching. I finished 27th overall, but one of the reasons I didn't come close to the top 10 was the pitching just wasn't there. And this was with me being very active, making a lot of moves, being aggressive, like streaming pitchers. You just need to have, you need to get an ace level of performance from somebody. Like you can't have just a bunch of twos and threes and hope for the best. It doesn't work.
Right. So it can be Aaron Nola, who you didn't take necessarily in the first 10 picks. You just really need to nail that guy.
No, that's absolutely right. And that's a good point too. You don't necessarily have to get an ace. It's just that, and I've identified this, I don't know if you remember reading this article, I wrote it last year, but I tweeted out a few days ago, really, for all the mythology about how starting pitching is unreliable and, you know, you never know, for the most part, we do know that the top 15, if you link them, that if you ban them out that way, are mostly reliable. It doesn't mean they all are. Some of them fail or fall apart or get hurt. When you get past that top 15, there's so many pitchers in each band that fall below replacement level. I think what I found a couple of years ago, there were two in the top 15 that fell below replacement level, which again, you know, if you're a $5 pitcher, that's still not good, but you're getting something back. Whereas, you know, in those other bands, if you've got 6 out of 15 pitchers below replacement level, it feels like you're throwing a dart.
Yep.
Yeah. And I think that's what people miss, you know, about the, you know, should I or shouldn't I take a pitcher early or should I wait on pitchers? You can hit with those pitchers, but we all think we're really smart. And, you know, it's a funny thing with people, and I do this too, so I'm not picking on anybody. We all tweet out our picks in these drafts and like, this guy's great, this guy's great, that guy's great. It's like, well, somebody is going to fail. It's just the way this works. Like somebody, you know, as Matt Groening once said, you know, somebody has to be the worst. Like it's the idea that someone's going to lose. And in these expert leagues and in the tougher NFBC leagues in particular, someone who is prepared and really went into this trying is going to finish last.
No doubt. The other reality is it always cracks me up. Like I won last year because I took Blake Snell, and I knew Blake Snell was going to be the breakout pick of this year. If you knew Blake Snell was going to be the breakout pick last year, A, you should be doing something other than playing fantasy baseball. And two, why did you wait until pick 169 to take him? That was his ADP last year. Like if right. I knew, forget his ADP, if I knew definitively that Blake Snell was about to do Blake Snell things, I wouldn't take that risk. I would take him at pick 190. Like you have to jump him up. You can't let you thought Blake Snell had a really nice slider and some nice stuff and it was a good so you thought here was the scenario that he could break out. But like Aaron Sanchez went two picks before him last year in the NFBC main, right? Gio Gonzalez went 10 picks ahead of him. John Gray, who I thought was going to be awesome, went 15 picks. Boy, that was stupid.
Well, years ago was Severino. Severino was like, I think in the like 300, like low, well, close to the 200s, but in the 300s, I believe. You know, in his breakout year, it's that whole thing about these pitchers. Like we know they have the potential. We just don't know. Like we don't know for sure, like what they're going to do. If we did, you know, we'd probably be like betting on games in Vegas, like specific games and making a lot more money. You know, we'd all be cleaning up in DFS.
Yeah. And I don't know how much you've incorporated. Like, there's so much more information that there was 5-7 years ago about pitchers. Like, it's staggering. You could literally spend 12 hours a day from the day the World Series ends until opening day doing nothing but getting super granular on pitchers. Yeah. And I like doing it and it's helpful, but there is a point I find of diminishing return also. Like at a certain point it's just too much and you start contradicting yourself. Like I can make a case for almost any pitcher on why this pitcher has the potential, if they just fix a few things, to be really good, and also why that's not going to happen. That here are all the problems with this pitcher.
Well, there's two problems, and one problem is that I've made this point too. There's great articles that people write that I better than I ever could about spin rate and, you know, mechanics and changes and approach. What we often, these articles are descriptive. They're not predictive.
Yep.
Like we don't know if the pitcher can hold that change or if he has the ability, by change, I mean, you know, change to approach, not change up, but we don't know if he can hold that change to approach, if it's going to carry over from season to season, you know, if there's going to be some consistency. We can make a guess, you know, we can look at the staff. Like, remember a few years ago when everyone was talking about Ray Searidge and how great Ray Searidge was and everything that Searidge did was magical? You know, somebody went back a couple years later and looked at the pitchers who were, in particular, who were traded to Pittsburgh, and what they found for the most part is those changes didn't hold. Like, they worked for a while, but ultimately the pitcher, Avon Nova was a great example. Remember that little sliver of a season he had with the Pirates after he was traded from the Yankees? And people were like, Ray Searidge is a genius. And then, you know, the next year, Nova went back to being okay. And
But even more on Ray Searidge, if Ray Searidge is the wizard, why did Garrett Cole have to go to Houston to get to become Garrett Cole? Why did Charlie Morton have to leave? Why did Tyler Glasnow like every, to the extent you believe Tyler Glasnow is about to become a star pitcher mm-hmm. in this league, I don't blame Ray Searidge. But if Ray Searidge had magical powers to turn any pitcher into a top notch pitcher, it should have happened with Gerrit Cole in Pittsburgh. It didn't. Right.
Well, and there's some of that is what you just talked about. There's more information than we used to have. And some of that information about Searidge is that he's very good, or he's excellent at working with a specific type of pitcher.
Yeah.
Beyond that, it's like, if this pitcher doesn't have a specific pitch mix or can't make those pitches excel, then Ray Searidge isn't really going to do much for you, except maybe someone like Nova or Jay Happ when he was there make you look great in the short term, but then in the long term just kind of make you look okay. So there was a second point I was going to make off of the besides the pitch mix and all of that. The other problem is that, and we all know this, and this is something that you mentioned Ron Chandler has talked about for years. The stats we use in fantasy aren't good indicators of how good a pitcher actually is. Or a better way of putting that, a pitcher could put up a 3.5 or a 3 and have the same or a very similar year, and we don't really know it. Fantasy stats aren't the most instructive stats when it comes to determining how good a pitcher is.
No doubt. And it's something I've talked about a lot this offseason. We're all too smart. Like Nick Pivetta coming off of a 4.77 ERA a decade ago would be somebody going in the 20th round. And there'd be a few of us who would realize, he was really actually pretty good. It's all superficial. Like look at his strikeout rate, look at his walk rate, and you got to grab him in the 20th round. Nick Pivetta is not a force. And people would look at you funny when you took Nick Pivetta. I don't know if you remember when James Shields had a really bad, back when James Shields was somebody you'd consider drafting. He had a brutal season, and everybody sharp knew you got to take James Shields. He wasn't really that bad, and you got him real cheap in drafts, and it worked out.
Well,
it doesn't. There's none of that anymore. Everybody knows Nick Pivetta's actually good. It wasn't a real 4.77. You're right. Yeah. Even if you're not as high on Nick Pivetta as some people are, nobody thinks he's bad, and that's why he's got hype behind him.
Right, he's not going to go in the 20th round. Like someone, even people like us who aren't the biggest Pivetta fans will look at him and go, yeah, I mean, obviously I have to take Pivetta. Like there's enough there that I could get a big payoff. And if I don't at this price, who cares? And yeah, I remember leagues, and like you, I'm, AL and only for me, it was high school. I remember being in leagues where you and one other person read Baseball America or even knew what it was. And you'd bring up some rookie and 10 people or 8 people in the room would laugh and be like, you're minor leaguers, why would you bother with them? He won't even be up, or, he hasn't proven anything yet. And you're thinking, whatever. And, you and this person are bidding like 5, 6, 7, 8, and finally the person lets him go and you won the league, or the other person won the league, you had the most money at the end.
As the other people are frantically turning through their magazine to see who is this guy they're talking about in the magazine that they're looking at as they're drafting. Yeah. I miss those days.
I do too. I mean, but it's in some ways being in more competitive leagues is more fun. After a while, you're kind of like, all right, I can beat these same, 6 to 8 people over and over and over. So you had touched upon this before. I think we covered it. No trading in NFBC. I think we mostly covered how that impacts your strategy. I guess since we cover most of those topics, how do you manage your FAB in a league like that? Like, does that come into play at all?
Huge. So it really depends on my closer situation. If my closer, I don't keep this a big secret. I don't like spending a ton on closers on saves, but they're part of the game. And, if I'm coming out of the draft and we're in April and I've got 2 or 3 closers that are going, have the job getting saves, then it gives me all kinds of flexibility to be going after starting pitchers with my FAB money. If, on the other hand, like I have 1/2 or 1/3 of a closer and I'm going to it's very obvious I'm going to be chasing saves with my FAB, it's really hard to be swapping big time pitchers. You can obviously do it on the margins, but everybody sees the pitcher who's getting, you know, Baltimore this week, or is going, you know, Miami, and then San Diego. Everybody sees that, and you need to bid real money to get those starting pitchers. Yeah. And it's just really tough to be doing that. And closers, it is the most compelling argument to me to spend on closers at the draft table. It's not there's so many teams that are uncertain, therefore you should spend on the closers that are good. No, because they're going to lose their job too, or they'll get traded. Like, that's how it goes. It's to the extent you can nail closers, it gives you the flexibility A, to bid on Juan Soto when he gets called up, and B, to use your money to stream pitchers.
Yeah. I mean, and, you know, the person who won Labor NL last year, you know, Howard Bender, he won because of Soto. Like, that was really, and some of that victory was he had enough saves. You kind of hit on all the points. He had enough saves in tow that he wasn't sitting there, you know, keeping money for saves or keeping money for starting pitchers. His team did get thin at the end because it was an only and he ran out of fab and he had some injuries, but, you know, Soto was good enough that it that's what won it for him. Now, you know, if Soto hadn't worked out, of course he doesn't win, but that's a player to me who, especially in only, is a good player to sink a lot of your fab into and roll the dice.
It's a pretty good percentage play. Like if that's not hindsight bias, even when called up, it was pretty clear he's a difference maker.
He was going to get a real shot. Like, and you know, if you're going to point to someone like, say, Kyle Tucker and go, well, you know, Kyle Tucker wasn't good, and he was also a highly regarded prospect. It's like, well, that was a very different situation with Kyle Tucker. When Kyle Tucker came up, the Astros were stacked, and could Tucker have broken through last year and been great? Sure, but it wasn't as clear that was the case as it was with Soto.
100%. Yeah, no, I agree.
So I want to close out on a topic that we've talked about. I think we've badgered people about on Twitter. You talk about how, you know, we just talked about Walker Buehler at the open of the show. You might be the only person last year who disliked Luis Castillo as a fantasy proposition. I'm not talking about dynasty or long term, but specifically in redraft in 2018. So I kind of want to, you know, start with the first thing. Why was everybody not only so high on Castillo, but they almost couldn't see the possibility that he could fail? Like, that was a part that amazed me. It wasn't so much that people were high on him. I saw him in Arizona when I went out to Labor, and I get it. I get why you can get excited about Castillo and be all into him and think, wow, this guy, if he works everything out, is going to be terrific. But why were so few analysts, some really sharp people too, unable to see that possibility of failure?
Yeah, like as anybody who follows me on Twitter knows, I get into a lot of political discussions, Canadian political discussions. I've talked the Middle East. I've talked abortion. Nothing has gotten the vitriol more than talking about Luis Castillo and why he might fail last year. People were so angry about it, and I think it was how he finished. Like it was he was so strong down the stretch in 2017, and look at the stuff, and the stuff is good. Like, his changeup is legitimately, I don't know if it's a top 5 pitch or a top 10 pitch. It's one of the best pitches in baseball, his changeup.
The fastball has like ridiculous movement. Well, the thing with Castillo for me, and this is my issue in 2017, it's not the stuff, it's the consistency. And I just wondered, given the small sample of innings, and I've seen pitchers like this who, you know, throw with a lot of movement and, you know, have that nasty stuff, would he be consistent? And I was skeptical that he would maintain that consistency over a full season. That was my main issue with Castillo. I didn't think he was bad. I just thought, well, he strikes as a pitcher who's going to have a month or a stretch where he just doesn't have it or can't find it. And as a result, is going to put up, like, you know, something closer to a 4 than a 3. And like you, people got mad at me. People were like, how can you say this? Like, that can't be true. Like, I've never seen a pitcher who's, you know, this good, such and such and such. And again, it's like, no one's arguing the ceiling with you. And I would guess at some point in his career, Luis Castillo is going to be an ace or something close to an ace. I just feel like for pitchers like this, for me, there's a large, like, there's error bars. Like, there's a large percentage of errors. And if Castillo had broken out last year and wasn't ace, I'd be like, yeah, at the price he was going for. And if you go back and look at ADP, too, for the most part, you know, I think outside of, like, Shohei Ohtani and Jake Arrieta, nearly all the pitchers in that band that Castillo was going in were better.
So his ADP in the NFBC main events last year was 80. He was 80.09. So getting beyond the stuff, like his
which is high, which is higher, by the way, than it was in the overall, like NFBC.
Oh yeah,
kind of bizarre.
It kept going and going and going. So that was the thing: is the I converted it into dollars, and then what does it take to become a $18 pitcher? I don't remember what the number is off the top of my head. And it's really hard. Like, a lot of things need to go right. And as a bet, the likelihood of Luis Castillo putting together a season where he earns, just breaks even. So forget turning a profit, which you need to do on your picks, as we've talked about. Let's say I'm happy given the risk associated with him. Like, if you're buying a stock that's a risky stock, you want some upside to that because you're taking risk. With Luis Castillo, by definition, he's never done it before. You're taking risk. And the notion that there was upside at pick 80 was hard to see. And it's one of those things, as I said to everybody, look, if I'm wrong, I'll sleep just fine missing out on an 80th pick overall Luis Castillo, but I think I'm going to be right. And nobody likes the fantasy pundit who brags about the things they get right, because everybody forgets
all
the things they get wrong. But the process, I think, is what's important. Well, I think that's why you rate it.
Well, that's what it is for me. I don't care if anything – I don't care that I was right on Luis Castillo. What I care about, I want people – there's still people, because he had a good second half last year, who are coming back and claiming some level of success. And I'm like, look, if this is your idea of success, we need to have a talk, because this isn't success. Like, you know, there was someone who came to you and was like, well – you know, Carlos Carrasco also had a bad first half. He had a 4-1-3 in the first half. And I'm like, look, Carlos Carrasco was drafted, I believe, and you might have the main event numbers in front of me. I don't, yet you're at an advantage there. But Carrasco, looking at the broader ADP numbers I had, was a third round pick.
Yeah, and 30th pick overall in the main.
Okay, so you're again, you have a little higher there than his overall, but you know, the idea stands, which I think at one point in the first half he was returning lower value. He still came back and was really close to still a loss, but he was really close to what he was taken at. Luis Castillo was just not close. Like, he just wasn't close at all to his where he was drafted. And that's really the game to me. The game is value more than anything else. And yes, it's nice to have a player that you're enamored with and who's fun, you know, and Vlad Jr. is a great example. Eloy Jimenez is an example. Mondesi, you know, maybe he's an example. But at some point, unless you're in a keeper and you've got those players cheap, you don't want to reach for them so far where you're just taking a loss and, you know, feeling good about your pick. You know, one thing in industry and leagues, and I've seen this less than I've seen it before. People will do this in no stakes leagues or magazines where there's, you know, it's not playing out. They'll take a Guerrero really early and they'll do it so they can talk about Guerrero. And if for some reason Guerrero puts up the 90th percentile season, they can go back to the magazine the next year and say, hey, I took Guerrero in the second round. And it's like, well, that's good, but it's just not really instructive, particularly when, you know, whether it's NFBC or a home league where you're putting your actual money on the table, you know, there's stakes as opposed to just bragging rights.
Yep. And look, if you think, and again, we're talking pitchers, but if you think that Vlad Guerrero is coming up on April 10th and he's going to be a top 15 hitter this season, and this is the reason why, then taking him in the third round is possibly an extraordinary pick. And if that, right. If you're making a rational argument for that, cool. Like, it's your team. You should do that. That's just very different from the emotional.
Yeah, that's a good point to make as well, is there are sometimes rational arguments to take players above their ADP, and that's the other side of it, which is, well, you know, if you have a reason, like last year I was pretty high, well, relative to market on David Price, and I had a rational argument about, you know, when it's funny, I'm looking at his final numbers because they're in front of me. I was like, is he going to be an ace? No, but I think he's going to put up 170, 180 good innings. And at the price he's going for, he's a bargain. He's on a good team. You know, he should win some games. I know wins are variable. He kind of did what I expected him to do. He wasn't a superstar, but, you know, at the price he was going for, he was a bit of a bargain. And, you know, again, that's kind of what we're looking at with pitchers. We know they're going to be volatile, but we want a bit of a bargain. You know, if we can get a Corbin or a Snell, that's great. But, you know, Corbin was the guy I was thinking of earlier, Rob. You know, you were talking about Snell. You know, Corbin's ADP is kind of hilarious because, you know, he was falling in this band of pitchers where you're like, well, there's Lance Lynn, there's Lucas Giolito, there's Julio Teheran, who was certainly good. You know, there's Jake Faria, there's Jordan Montgomery, and there's Corbin sitting in between all these pitchers where you're like, yeah, if we knew Corbin was going to be that good, we're not taking him in the 200s.
And there's also a big difference, and this is almost a trite statement to make. There is a big difference between saying somebody at pick 300, I think this guy could break out in a mixed league, especially. Labor is a different situation. Any only league, it's a different situation. But if I have a flyer at pick 300, the cost of being wrong is nothing. I literally can cut him the next week. Pick 80, I don't need to be right. You can I won the overall, I had bad picks. Byron Buxton was a bad pick when I won the overall. I mean, that's 3 years ago now, and I've made a bad pick with Byron Buxton. It's the first in an ongoing series of bad Byron Buxton picks that people have made.
He's going to hit 100 home runs this spring, though, so it's okay.
There's nothing I've been more certain about in my life. No, I've been off Byron Buxton for a while. But no, like, you should take risks late. There's just such a difference between taking those late flyers and taking the 80th pick overall as a flyer.
Well, that's the thing. I'm looking at the back end from last year. You know, you had Fulton Evich, you had Walker Buehler. You know, those are pitchers at the beginning of last year that you wanted over CC Sabathia or Mike Minor or Matt Harvey. You know, even Eduardo Rodriguez is someone at his ADP. You know, he didn't really throw a lot of innings. But you're absolutely right. That's the kind of pitcher you want. Like Zach Davies, you know, honestly, you can find yourself a Zach Davies in the free agent pool if Fulton Evich hadn't worked out.
So I wrote about this in my starting pitcher ADP piece that's up on the website at BP now, and I don't know how clear I was because it's something I still struggle with to get my head around, but I think it's an important insight. In mixed leagues, it's a weekly game, and by a weekly game, I mean you get to set your roster, let's say it's once a week, every Monday before lock, 26 times. And if you draft Max Scherzer, you're starting him. It doesn't matter if you're in Colorado or anywhere else. If he's healthy, he's in your lineup. So he's one of your 9 times 26. So you're starting him every single week, guaranteed. And lots of guys at the top end are like that. But we need to get out of the mindset and valuations. There's no other way to do it, but valuations takes the full 26-week season, the 6-month season, and says, this is what this guy did. Projections say, this is what I think he will do over the full 6-month season. When in reality, if Jason Vargas is starting against Miami the second week of the season, I want Vargas on my roster, and then I want him off my roster as soon as that's over. And the value of that one start for that 1 week, because why? Because literally anybody this year against Miami will be one of your 9 best pitchers, unless your pitching staff is stacked. And we're very bad at capturing the value of that one Vargas start to my team, and how that incorporates into what we're ultimately trying to do, which is maximize stats by the end of the season.
Well, it's funny you say that, because my valuations, which are SGP based, really try to focus on that, but I admit they're imperfect for that reason, because, you know, a pitcher, if he has one good start and then 10 bad ones, that one good start in the great matchup gets buried. That's the biggest problem with Z-score valuations. Like, I think about the example when, you know, Reese Hoskins came up and was terrific, you know, through that, what was it, like a 6 or 8 week stretch his rookie year, whatever it was. And because of replacement level, he was just plugged into a formula with everybody for a full season and was behind like these mediocre players who had played the full season. So, and with pitching, that's even more so. Like you really are in a position where we're not judging pitchers properly. And you see this with the PFM, like the PFM, most of the top pitchers, it almost looks like a point structure where the pitchers who are projected for a lot of innings, even if their ERAs are kind of are ranked higher. A great example is a reliever, and this is last year's valuations. Wade Davis is ranked really highly, even though he had an ERA just north of 4. Now, granted, the whip was good because he had all those saves. Like that's what the PFM is valuing. Yes, that's important. But on some level, and particularly with starting pitchers, that week to week, and that's a great point you made, Rob, in the article. And by the way, you did state it well. That week to week is vital. And with the exception of your Scherzers, or you know, maybe you have a staff with like two pitchers on that level, everyone is theoretically replaceable. And especially in a league with flexible fab or reserve list, you have to have the mindset that you're not afraid to reserve somebody, or if it's somebody, you know, toward the bottom third of your staff, just dropping and be like, you know what, I can find this pitcher, you know, later on.
And it's a concept that, like, I don't play much fantasy. I didn't play any fantasy football this year for the first time since I was probably 15 years old. But fantasy football players get this, right? They don't want the running back who's getting 40 yards and zero touchdowns every week, even if at the end of the season, because they played all 16 weeks, they're running back 18. It's like you are never a top 24 running back in any one week. So you're a terrible option. And the season long, but you were running back 18, it's like you just stayed healthy when nobody else stayed healthy. Right. And I'm not criticizing any one person or one system of valuations. It's a change of mindset. Obviously, NL only, AL only, leagues with roster transactions, totally different ballgame. Sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry, it was interrupting you.
No.
Finish your point.
I think I've more than finished the point. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that the tough thing is exactly that, which is, and I made this mistake at the beginning. If you plug in an average or above average player every week who's safe, you're going to finish in fourth place. Like that's the road to fourth place. Like you're not going to win. So, and in a mixed league where you have any kind of roster flexibility, that's the whole idea. The whole idea is not to just sit back, you know, with your good or fourth place team and go, these players are all safe. The idea is to try to maximize that value. Like, and maximizing that value is by, if you can work the margins, you know, and pitching is especially where you can work those margins. It's harder with hitting. It's harder, especially in a weekly league, because yes, there's one or two hitters where, you know, you might have someone like, you have two hitters who are close to equal. One hitter's in Colorado. You know, the other hitter is going to, you know, face the Astros on the road in tough matchups, and you're like, all right, I'm going to go with the hitter in Colorado. But for the or you have a platoon differential. But for the most part, hitting is more of a grind. You're going to run the same hitters out there week in and week out. Maybe Ramon Laureano comes up, and you know, I grabbed him late in a few leagues and was set, you know, pretty slick with that or attentive. One great advantage of working for Baseball Prospectus, by the way, is or subscribing. If you devour the prospect articles, you can be ahead on someone like Laureano and really, you know, be aware. And you know, other sites do that too. But for the most part with hitters, you're just not going to do that. Pitching is really where you have to grind and make those plays. And the fantasy football analogy is a good one.
And those of us who believe in projections and believe in projection models, in real life, that's one of the hardest things to do is deciding, Danny Duffy's not happening this year, so it doesn't matter what I spent on Danny Duffy. I got to move on right now. Even if a projection says, no, be patient. Danny Duffy is still projected. His true talent is still a 4 ERA. It's like, no, I can't wait anymore. I have to move on. The balance between patience, because you should be patient and you should believe the projections, you should believe in true talent, and this just isn't happening. I need to turn this roster spot. I have to move on is incredibly hard, and it's obviously more art than it is science in making those calls most years.
Yeah, there's almost a gut feel to it, for lack of a better sense. And the thing I'll add to that is that if you make a bad move, like if last year, we've talked about this, and you were surprised. I cut Trevor Williams in an NL only.
Yeah.
And, you know, people forget, you know, he was bad at one point. It was a league where you could trade. I was trying to trade him. Nobody wanted him.
Why would they want Trevor Williams? This was even terrible.
Right. Well, this is even Tout Wars where, like, you can just trade Fab. I was like, hey, I'll take five Fab for me out of 1,000. Nobody wanted to do it. So I cut him, and, you know, someone picked him up for almost nothing. And, you know, he went on to that ridiculous end. And you can't beat yourself up if you cut someone like a Duffy and instead it turns into Trevor Williams. It's just the way the game is. And, you know, Williams, you know, I did the Pirates section in the annual. I kind of analyzed after the season what had happened. And, you know, essentially with Williams, what had happened was he has a good fastball. All of his secondary pitches are average at best, but Searidge worked with him perfectly on approach. And, you know, as opposed to just kind of throwing the pitches and seeing where they'd fall, like really attacking the zone and having a plan. And that's what happened with Williams. Was he lucky? Of course he was lucky, but he could be an average like starter this year, maybe a little bit below average with that approach. And that's some of what it comes down to. There's a lot of luck with pitching. A pitcher can go on a 10 or 12 start streak where they're much better, you know, or they're pitching much better than you would expect, because it's the nature of pitching.
There's no doubt. And finding pitchers who can go against Miami and Baltimore also really helps.
Yeah. So do you have anything else to add? We've actually gone a little bit over, but that's fine. I could talk to you for another hour, but I don't want to subject our listeners or our producers. Do you have any final thoughts?
No, I mean, we haven't really talked about individual pitchers, but we'll save to be fair, both of us have a lot of stuff up on the website. I have an interesting head-to-head tail of the tape going onto the website tomorrow on Tuesday morning of Andrew Heaney and Tyler Glasnow, who are a trickier pairing than you'd think to pick one of the winners. So you have to be a subscriber and check that out on Tuesday at BP.
Yeah, they're pretty close for me as well. All right,
my God, Pecota hates Andrew Heaney though. I don't understand why Pecota hates Andrew Heaney so much. But anyways, that's another story.
All right, we'll take a quick break and we'll wrap up. Once again, thank you for listening to episode 187 of Flags Fly Forever. Rob Silver, thank you once again for joining us on this edition of Starting Pitchers. We didn't go through the tiers, but we had a great discussion. So
that was a lot of fun.
Yep. So once again, for Rob Silver, for Jim Macramos behind the glass, and for me, Mike Gianella, this has been Flags Fly Forever. Next week, we'll be talking about labor. We'll be going through my NL-only auction, through Brett Sayer's AL-only auction, and hopefully we will not be droning on for too long and navel-gazing about our teams. We'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.